Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists discuss their most recent work. It was an honor today chatting with Paul Rozin, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Paul is one of the world's leading experts in a variety of fields, ranging from cultural to moral to social psychology. He has twice been a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and recipient of the American Psychological Association Distinguished Scientific Contribution Award for 2007. In this episode, Paul gives an update on his influential 2001 paper, Social Psychology and Science, Some Lessons from Solomon Asch, which criticized the way psychology was conducted at the time and is still being conducted today. In a far-reaching conversation, we discuss what natural and social sciences can learn from each other, why psychology should identify with both, what Paul's relationship with Solomon Asch was like, why people's tendency to focus on the negative is especially dangerous in the moral domain, and what it is like studying ethnic conflict. Finally, Paul announces his new and upcoming book. I really enjoyed this conversation and hope you enjoy it too. Today, I have the big honor of speaking with Paul Rozin. Thank you, Paul, for coming on the podcast, first of all.
My pleasure.
So we have a big range of topics we want to discuss today, and this can be a free-ranging conversation, but maybe a good starting off point is the paper you published in 2001 that you sent me called Social Psychology and Science, Some Lessons from Solomon Asch. Maybe as a broad introduction, what were you trying to argue in this paper, and what was it motivated by?
Well, I have a joint PhD in biology and psychology, and I took a little of medical school. I like to take classes, so I did a lot of that in graduate school. And so I have sort of two disciplines in my head. And then I became primarily a psychologist and became part of a psychology department all my life. And I originally worked with animals and worked on what you might call biological psychology. And I gradually shifted to becoming more of a social scientist. I started out as very much a natural scientist. I moved more and more to being a social scientist. And one reason for that was that I was interested in food, how animals and people relate to food. And the more I studied people and food, the more I realized that it was primarily about culture. And so because I was interested in food, I moved over to being more culturally oriented. So when I entered the cultural aspects of psychology, one major piece of it is called social psychology. I discovered they had their own mores, they had their own traditions, and they sort of weren't the ones that I came in with. And I was struck by that, and I had trouble dealing with journal editors and so on. I'd say, this is what I found. And they say, well, how do you know you found that we have these criteria? And I realized that I had a different sense of what science was than they did. And this paper was an attempt for me to say what another way of seeing science than the way social psychology sees it. And it was a way that I thought Solomon Asch, who A-S-C-H, who was, in my view, the great social psychologist of the 20th century, the way he saw it, much more situated in contexts, much less with the trappings of science, as opposed to the fundamental motive of science, which is to understand the world.
So that's interesting, because a common understanding is that biology is a natural science. It studies something that is actually real, whereas psychology sometimes still has to justify its position in the science department in some universities, right? It studies mental phenomena that aren't as real as the biological facts. And what you seem to be saying is that this is not necessarily helpful, and it's much more complex to distinguish the two.
I am saying that, but I'm also saying that we can apply much of what biological science has learned about how to understand things to our more complicated things. But rather than simply trying to use their elements, their neurons and things like that, the idea is to think about the way they think about dealing with the problem. So, for example, observation is absolutely fundamental in biological science. And psychologists tend to dismiss it as it's just an observation. You know, they want an analysis of cause, an analysis of mechanism. But before you have to study something, you better make sure it's interesting and real. And various areas of psychology have made the mistake of finding something in the laboratory, spending decades studying it, and never asking what it really is. What does it mean for humans or animals? So my thought was I would try to bring some of this perspective to the field. And one particular thing is that our field, most of modern psychology is built on the idea of experiments. The experiment is a great technique, and it is probably the most powerful way to figure out cause, but it's not the only way to study things and understand them. In fact, astronomers and geologists can't do experiments, right? They can't change things back hundreds of years ago or millions of miles from us, and they've done very well. So my thought is that we should do experiments, but we should do them after we sort of almost know what's going on. Not quite, but we have a pretty good idea of what we're studying, and then we do experiments.
It's interesting. In the paper, you cite justifications for research in biology journals, and you say that sometimes people just justify their research by saying, I thought this would be interesting. And this is, you know, basically the literature background. I don't know if this is still true, but in psychology, if one were to write this in a paper draft right now, it would never get published, right? People would say, no,
it would never get published. And one thing I point out in that paper is that the four empirical papers that were the basis, were cited in the most important paper in biology, probably in science in the later 20th century or maybe the whole 20th century, which was Watson and Crick's analysis of the structure of DNA and therefore genes. There were the four empirical papers they cite, none of them would have gotten published in a psychology journal. And they were all of the sort, this looks interesting, let's take a look. You don't have to have a hypothesis. You say, basically, they all said, this DNA, this seems like it's really important in genes. Let's see what its structure is. Let's see how it's made. And that is that's a powerful question, and it led to enormous advances. But you would not get that paper published in a psychology journal. So, you know, that's, I think part of this is that psychology, as you said, is trying to be a science. Being a natural science is prestigious. That's probably the most prestigious area in the academic world. The public tends to believe it more than other things they hear from the academic world. And psychology is right on the margin of the natural sciences. In my history, it went from being a social science to a natural science. And many psych departments, including the one I have been in, fought to be included with physics, chemistry, and biology, and not with sociology, anthropology, political science, economics. And I understood that thought. I was part of it. I thought that was a good idea. But when they did that, they lost something about those other disciplines. That is that sense of a context, that sense of what is the thing I'm studying? How does it relate to other things?
And it also seems like if we build our research on something, that something has to be other research, right? It's very rare to find a paper that is built on a novel or a poem, right? Or other forms of knowledge and wisdom. Maybe there's a quote at the beginning of the paper, but then you start with the literature review of previous research. And so you're saying that maybe our discipline is too young to build on previous research. Maybe we need more exploration and broader fields. Is that a fair summary?
Yes. Well, another thing that happens in all fields, in all human life, is what I call fads. Something interesting happens and we all get excited about it. And often many of us drop what we're doing to work on that. So science is very faddy, and psychology was excited about being a natural science, being like biology, or even more physics. I really liked, we called it physics envy, you know, the sense that, boy, if we could only be like them. And it's a great science. It's probably the great science. And we would be well to try to imitate it in many ways. But we have to ground ourselves before we try to get too much like physicists or too much like biologists. So that's where I think we've made some mistakes. And after all, if you think about it, the other great work in biology of the last few hundred years is The Origin of Species by Darwin. That changed everything. And that was done by a set of observations by a very keen observer who didn't have any idea what he was looking at to start with. And he just gradually induced some principles. Now, he could never have published what he did, because he didn't publish most of it until he was all ready to be in a big package. But if he had tried as a young scientist now to do that, he would have had to publish along the way to keep his job, and he would have had trouble getting his papers published. And that's very sad, because that's maybe the greatest finding in the history of science, but certainly one of them.
You also You also argue that social psychology has not always been like this, right? There was Solomon Asch, who had a very different perspective on the field. And I know many people in my generation, we read about Asch in the textbooks. It's like this historical figure, one of the founders of the field, but you actually met him. So what was he like as a person? How did that maybe impact the kind of research he was doing?
Well, I call myself a cultural psychologist rather than a social psychologist, partly to distance myself from that and to welcome the link to anthropology and to the fact that the anthropologists, cultural anthropologists, go into a culture typically, traditionally, and they live there for a while and they get to try to figure out how these people work. And that's all observation, okay? Asch did that very briefly with the Hopi American Indians, but that wasn't the central event of his life. But so I came into the field late, so I didn't even know about Solomon Asch for most of my life. He was hired by my department I think he was about 60 when we hired him. He was past his prime. The great work that he wrote was in 1952. He wrote a book called Social Psychology. He's not as well known for that as some studies he did. But that book is the great book of social psychology. And it's so literate and so thoughtful. And so I met him and got to know him. I was his chair, actually, in the department for some years. And then he retired and he left the department and went to live in Princeton. The department is University of Pennsylvania, by the way. We don't know. And I kept in touch with him and I became very close to him. And actually, I ended up being essentially his son. And by a fluke of history, my mother died, my older parent died, my last parent, and his only son died in the period of a few weeks. And when I came to offer him condolence about his son, I slipped into the role of his son, because I had lost my last parent and he had lost his only child. And it was a wonderful, so it was a mixture of a familial and intellectual relationship. So what's special about Asch is that, well, first of all, when he starts his book, he asks questions like, what does it mean to know another mind? Now that's the fundamental question of the social world, but how do I know that you've got something in your head like I have? That isn't even discussed in social psychology. It happens to be discussed in developmental psychology. People have been interested in how kids get a sense that there are other minds. But I mean, that's the first thing to ask. And he asks these kinds of questions. How do we fit into a culture? And these are the kinds of questions that I think a fundamental social psychology should ask. So I think everyone should read the first third of his book. Then he gets more specific. So I read that and I got excited by that. And at the same time, I was influenced by another person, a little somewhat later, actually, Richard Schwader, who was a University of Chicago anthropologist, sort of the founder of cultural psychology. You, of course, have an Hazel Marcus in your department, one of the great people in the field. And I spent a year with him at Stanford, actually. And I realized that the world I was looking at was a tiny piece of the world. Americans make up less than 5% of the people in the world. The great majority of the world, 75 to 80%, is what we call second or third world, or developing world is a better word. And those people are in many ways different. And those were people who interested me. And I spent some time studying them, partly inspired by Schwinger. And that, of course, is a growing field now. In psychology, there's a growing interest in not studying Homo sapiens americanus, but rather Homo sapiens. And for some purposes, including some of the most advanced areas of psychology, like how our eye represents the world, it doesn't matter whose eye you use. You can use a Vietnamese farmer, you know, an American programmer, whatever you want. But if you want to understand how people think about other people, or how people have values of different sort, you can't use a Silicon Valley programmer as your representative of our species. So that grew out of my interest in ASH. ASH was what's called the Gestalt psychology. That was a movement primarily in understanding the sensory system's vision, particularly vision. And the idea of Gestalt psychology, which, by the way, originated in Germany, and the great psychologists, two of the great ones are Hans Bollack and Wolfgang Köhler. They both moved to America. And the whole point of Gestalt psychology is we have to put things in context. We can't just look at individual elements. It's the organization of the elements that matters. So if I put up this, you see two groups of three, right? Now, why do you do that? Well, the whole idea is we organize the world in certain ways to make sense of it. And the whole point of Gestalt is we have to look at a bigger universe than just the tiny things we're studying. And when Ash got into Gestalt psychology, he translated it, and some others did too, into the social domain, that we have to put social behavior in its context.
There's this beautiful quote from Ash that speaks to this point. And this is a quote you reference in the paper where he says, most social acts have to be understood in their setting and lose meaning if isolated, right? And this, of course, is a very interesting understanding, especially nowadays with our generalizability crisis, where we want every finding to apply to everyone. And some people have pointed out that people are different, especially cultural psychologists. Now, maybe we don't need every finding to apply to everyone, because then we miss out on cultural specifics and differences across the human sphere. And it's not just between cultures, right? So I know that Jonathan Haidt, who of course was your student, and then Rick Schrader was his postdoc advisor. Right? When he tried to study culture, he realized that in Chicago, you just have to leave the UChicago campus and go a few streets south, and you're in a different culture altogether, right? Don't necessarily have to fly to another country, right? And so there's culture within countries.
Oh, absolutely. Different cultures. Absolutely. And social class represents, in many ways, different cultures. Haidt and I both spent some time in India, in the same city. It was the city that Schrader worked in. And we both believe that our whole worldview was changed by that experience. We just saw a different way of evaluating things. Not better or worse, just different. Let me just give one example that comes from that period. This originally comes from some work by Schrader, which I extended. So the question asked was, what doesn't belong of these three terms? So they're going to go, you're going to put two together and one separate, okay? So if I said, just say truck, car, potato, you'd say potato doesn't belong, right? Right, okay. So we say shame, anger, happiness. Which of those three, if you have to sort them, which would be the different one? Now, almost all Americans will say happiness doesn't belong, because shame and anger are negative and happiness is positive. Perfectly reasonable. But Schrader did this with eight very religious Hindu Indians. Originally, and I extended it to a much wider group of people in India. All eight of his people said that anger doesn't belong. They put shame and happiness together. And when I did it with Indian college students, about half of them said that. So the question is, why would they say that? And the answer is, and I'm going to tell you this, and you're going to see it right away. They say that shame and happiness are socially constructive, and anger is socially destructive.
Mm.
Now, you can see what they're saying, that shame, by feeling bad that you did something wrong, you're helping the system to work, right? So the interesting thing about it is that, and Indians will understand right away why we say negative and positive. The point of this is that there's a different way of looking at the world. Their first look is different. They can understand our view. We can understand it. But when they first look at the world, they see things differently. They value things differently. And that's really important to understand. It's important to understand to help to create world peace. It's important to understand yourself. And so I think that I call that different cultural defaults. That is to say, the first way you think about something is different than others. There are many differences. And Hazel Marcus and your department has been fundamental in working some of those out. But the point is that we have to learn from that. It's not just that we learn that the people in the world are different. We learn about ourselves. So why don't we think? Why don't we sort things by whether they make the social world work or not? We can understand that. So it gives us insight into ourselves. And I think cultural psychology has been a very important influence. It's still a budding field. It's a minority field. There aren't many people in it, in psychology. But it's raised issues and made people think twice. Made people, and now more people are looking at people from other cultures, even in social psychology. So anyway, that's part of the context issue, which comes out of the Gestalt issue. The issue of looking at, if you're looking at an animal behaving, you don't want to look at the animal independent of its environment, like it's behaving in a vacuum. It's behaving in response to other things, either objects in the environment or other organisms. Obviously, you're going to do that. So the problem is that as we develop a science, we find interesting things and we dig down and study them. And that's good. But we have to remember that that's not the only thing. So lots of social psychologists might be studying one phenomenon, like say attribution, how it is that we decide what someone's motive was doing something. That's very important. But there are other things to study. So I when I study food, I think food's an important part of human life. I think it has meaning for people. It's not just nutrition. And yet psychology hardly studies food. Because psychology has been interested primarily, not just social psychology, all psychology, in basic processes like motivation, perception, memory. Those are really important things to study. But they vary in interesting ways depending on what their object is. So the idea is not to make a choice that we're only going to do it one way, but to let many flowers bloom. As somebody said, I forgot who was the first person who said that. Somebody said that. And I think that's important. And we can sort the flowers and we can say these are the best, most interesting ones. But you first got to see them. Yeah.
It seems like we're very concerned with avoiding what is called type one error in science, right? We have a finding, we think it's true, but actually it's not. And of course, we want to avoid it, right? You don't want to be a scientist, have a finding, write papers about it, speak to the public about it, and then turns out it's not true. But there's a type two error, right? Which is the opposite, which is where we miss out on findings. And, you know, this one is harder to detect because we just don't see what we miss out on, right? If someone has a finding but doesn't publish it, we never get to see it. We never get to experience the idea, and the error remains uncorrected in a sense. So what are some of the topics that you think are undetected, some important topics of study that social psychologists and other psychologists should focus on right now?
Well, first of all, the field has been, social psychology has been evolving. So now, for example, in the last 10 or 20 years, moral psychology has developed as a piece of social psychology. And by the way, as a piece of personality, the psychology of personality is quite an old field, but it never considered character. You would think that one of the most important things about people's differences is not our differences in their moral status, their moral views, their moral allegiances. And yet the field of personality doesn't talk about that. And in fact, until recently, a major model of the field said that there was competence and there was warmth. Those are the two basic dimensions of personality. So they're very important and they count for a lot, but there's no character in there. We did a number of us did a study that argued that you can't do that without character. The first thing you want to know about somebody, if you're going to get to know them, certainly if you're going to date them, is what's their character, right? So it took a long time. An old friend of mine, a philosopher, Joel Kupperman, wrote a book on characters decades ago, and he said the same about philosophy. That philosophy, there is moral philosophy, but it was mostly about moral conundrums. What do you do under these conditions? Individual cases and how you behave. Not moral trajectories, but moral trajectories are terribly important. And we run into that problem a lot in our culture, in every culture. When a good person does something bad, now what do you do about that when a good person does something bad? A good person meaning someone who you believe has good character and has a track record of good character, and they do something bad. We don't quite know how to handle that. It's a fascinating issue. But your whole life can go crashing down if you do something bad. I'm not saying that murder, I mean, that's a little too strong, but something dishonest. Most people make mistakes of all sorts, including moral mistakes. And we would like to say that we look at their trajectory, right? We look at their lifetime and say, have they been a good thing for their world, for their family, for their friends, for the world? Not have they ever made a mistake. And yet, well, just take an example, one that I'm interested in. Joe Paterno, who you may not know, was the football coach of Pennsylvania State. He was the exemplary American football coach. He was a great coach, but he really cared about his players' performance in school, and he really took care of all of that. He did this for decades. He was known. Then he got involved, not directly, indirectly, one of his close people working with him turned out to be a child molester. Okay, one of the people on his staff. And he had been warned once or twice, more than that, about this fellow doing things in the locker room that he shouldn't be doing with teenage kids and so on. And he reported it, but he sort of shook it off. He couldn't believe it. He knew this person well. Person was a pillar of the community. And the man was exposed. And Paterno's error in not reporting him more forcefully was revealed. And Paterno, who was the king of Penn State University, his statues were torn down. His life was ruined. And I thought that was just a great over-response. So we have to understand how people make an integrated view of a person. So if you hear that someone you really care about did something bad, your first thing is going to be not to believe it, right?
Yeah.
And first of all, you're probably right because you know that trajectory, but suppose you're wrong. Well, what do? You don't necessarily say, I'm going to throw them in the garbage can. You say, they made a mistake. That was bad. They should apologize. They should do something to make up for it, something. But so we have to deal with this. This is something I call negativity dominance. I've written a paper with a graduate student, Ed Roisman, Uzbeki graduate student, about this, that negative events tend to dominate positive events. So a lifetime of good work can be spoiled by a bad thing. The way in my own research, that's illustrated by the fact that you can drop a cockroach in a glass of juice, your favorite juice, and nobody will drink it, right? But what can you add to a bunch of cockroaches? What can you add to them to make them edible? Nothing. There's nothing. There's no anti-cockroach.
Yeah. Right?
And I ask people in my class, okay, someone committed a murder, a single murder, and how many lives would they have to save? Individually, each one is a separate lifesaver, taking at risk to themselves for you to say that they're back to the neutral moral point. And some people say no number, but the average number was about 10. So they'd be plus 9 in lives, right? And they'd go up in front of a jury for murder and they could be convicted and executed, even though they were plus 9 in human lives and the jury was 0 probably. So These negative events are powerful. And the reason for that is biological, partly, that negative events are powerfully important, death being the major negative event, right? And you have to be sure not to do anything that will get you killed. Doing something that's a positive thing, I'm not talking about a moral thing, getting a little food that's over there, that's important. But not eating poison is much worse. And so animals in general are biased to learn more quickly about negative things because they're so life-threatening. Okay? And so we see this in the moral domain. And I think it's a little we overshoot in the moral domain. And one reason that psychology has, not psychology hasn't caused this, but one reason it's important for psychology is we didn't have a psychology of character because we didn't study it. Everyone was studying how friendly you are, how upset you are about little things and all sorts of all interesting things about personality, but they weren't studying the big thing, which is how good a person you are, right? So anyway, we're changing that. But still, most of moral psychology right now is about events. Should you do this? The famous example, as I'm sure you know, and what many of your audience knows, is if you're sitting at a streetcar is coming down as the track splits, and there's a one person lying on the track on one side and five people lying on the track, and the car runs over them, it'll kill them. The car is set to run over the five people. That's the way the switch is. Should you pull the switch to push it over to the one? That's a fascinating and important question. But that's an event. It's a moral event. How about a moral lifetime? I think most people can tell you something they did that they thought they shouldn't have done in their life. That they just thought wasn't right. It doesn't have to be murder. It's probably not murder. It's something much less serious than that. But so we all do that. So anyway, so I got a little involved in moral psychology because of that. And of course, anger, shame, happiness is about moral things too, because making things work together socially is a moral goal for people. So you could see these emotions as morally relevant or not, depending on which your way of looking at things is. The American way was first to not look at them that way, just positive, negative. Anyway, so I think these are all things that I've been involved in, and other cultural psychologists have been involved in many other important things, including the American notion of self-esteem, as that's so important. That's a very individualistic idea. Stephen Heine at University of British Columbia and Hazel Marcus too have been involved in this. We just took it for granted that people had to enhance their self-esteem. But in Japanese culture, self-esteem is not a prominent theme because your self is not just you. It's your whole social environment. It's the people you care about. So I don't know if anyone's actually done this, but basically, if you have a sibling, let's say, who does better than you in something that you care about, that's sort of bad for your self-esteem, and you might be a little upset. Whereas you could imagine, if you think of the sibling as part of your world, that's a good thing for you. It makes your family's accomplishment great. So, you know, you can see how you could go different ways on this. And this is the kind of thing that cultural psychology has brought to us, a different way of looking at the world, particularly the Eastern way, which is mostly Japan and the research of seeing things as going together, communal, more gestalt-like, and the American way, which is to dissect things into individuals. It's the individual bounded by his or her skin, which is the unit of everything. And it isn't, in my sense, the only unit.
I see a theme here that connects some of these points. Let me try to see if this makes sense. This is something I really want to ask you, building on your negativity bias paper and research that you've done, right? And extending this to the moral domain. I agree that we really see people, if they do one bad thing, that just makes them a bad person overall. If they do one good thing, that doesn't necessarily make them a good person overall, right?
No, that's right.
Somewhat harsh, and we're somewhat distrustful. And one argument that I encounter when I talk about this is that people say, well, of course, it's adaptive to attune more to the negative. And in many domains, it is, right? There's another line of research that I've discovered that I find interesting by Dave Dunning and colleagues, who show that, why do we distrust people more than we rationally should, right? Why are we so skeptical? Yes, there is this evolutionary narrative, but there's also this explanation that we applied to science before about type 2 errors. If you distrust someone, if you trust someone and they exploit your trust, they cheat on you, they betray you, you notice this and it's really painful. However, if you don't trust someone, you don't see what you're missing out on, right? You don't see the benefits of cooperation you could have reaped. And once you correct for this information, people become somewhat more trustful, right? And so that seems like an interesting alternative narrative that is different from the, oh, it's adaptive, it's useful, let me distrust people because this is my personality, I see through things, right? I really know what's going on. Versus we just have this asymmetric feedback that in part drives this negativity bias.
I think that's right. But so the question is, we have this negative bias. No question about that. And we don't, it's not uniquely human. It's widespread. So the question is, when is it, and it was a general question, when we have these biological biases, when are they misplaced? Especially as we develop a culture and a complicated world that's so different from the natural world in which we evolve. When are these biases just misplaced? That did, you know, it's not appropriate. So there's no moral, there was no moral domain when negativity bias evolved, which it evolved many way before humans. There was no way before humans. It's probably present in all animals. So, you know, we have to, as we get and become enculturated individuals, we have to understand that we have to interpret our natural senses, our natural way of feeling, and maybe modify it so that, in fact, most people would probably say, I think there's a view that most people believe that most things they hear are true. I'm trying to remember now. It's Harvard. I'm old enough to stop forgetting names. Harvard psychologist. Social psychologist. Anyway, I'll think of his name. Very well known. Basically, it's right. Most of the things you hear are true.
I think it's Dan Gilbert, right?
Yes, Dan Gilbert. Right. Yeah. Thank you. So Dan Gilbert says most of the things you hear are true. So it makes sense to hear them. So, you know, when we try to understand conspiracy theory, you can start with the fact that our bias is that if you hear it, it's probably true. Now, and in the old days before the internet, a couple of people heard something absurd, they probably wouldn't repeat it. But now it gets out to millions of people. So the point is, though, that it's good that you believe most of the things you hear. On the other hand, you have to be critical of them. You don't have to disbelieve them. You have to say, how do they know that? How do I know that? So one of the things I'm writing about in my book on understanding science is how to try to get people to be critical but not skeptical of science. So be critical of what you hear, but don't not believe it. Simply say, I'd like to believe it. It makes sense. Now, let's see, does it actually hold? So you're going to be critical, but not skeptical. That's the trick. And it's a tricky thing to do that. And, you know, you have to practice it many times. Graduate students in the sciences and in all fields practice this all the time. They don't want to dismiss a finding, but they want to make sure it makes sense. And you know, we learn what evidence is. Nobody teaches evidence, you know, except in law school. But we learn what evidence is in science and in the humanities and other fields by discussing it, by saying, is that evidence for this? And you discuss it with other people. Say, do you think that makes it more likely that this is true or not? And we get socialized into thinking about evidence. And this is not overtly something that animals do. They may do it covertly. That is, that there's pieces of their brain that might, you know, assess whether how often it's the case that this means food, let's say. You know, they actually calculate these things without thinking about it. But we do it explicitly. We think about it. We say, is this a good signal for that? Well, we have to learn how to do that. And one of the big issues, which my colleague John Barron emphasizes, is we have to think of alternative accounts. We say, this is what people say, this causes that. Well, what else, what other account could we have of what causes? We tend not to do that. We just tend to accept a reasonable story and go on. But, you know, in science, we have to say, what are some alternative stories? And we in psychology are very good at that. We are very good at thinking of alternative accounts. And one thing we can do is destroy a good paper by saying, well, it could be this, it could be that. Yes, it could. But this is an interesting possibility I'm reporting. Let's see if it survives against alternative accounts. I, the author of it, can't eliminate all the alternative accounts because that'll take a long time. We have a feeling in our field that we have to settle an issue by studying a paper, by writing a paper. Mm-hmm. Instead of promote a problem, we have to settle it by running a whole bunch of studies to say, well, it isn't that, it isn't this. And that's not a good way to make progress because it's too tedious. Anyway, yeah, I got a little off the track there.
No, that was entirely on track. And you just casually mentioned that you're writing a book. And I think I wouldn't do justice to all our listeners by not asking you if you can give us a little bit of a spoiler for what the book is going to be about.
Sure. The book comes, first of all, it turns out I taught introductory psych for 40 years. And I realized, and it was not like anyone else's introductory psych. And I realized the reason it wasn't was most people who teach introductory psych teach what we know in psychology now. I didn't teach that. I said, here's the textbook. You can read that. That's what we know. I want to tell you how we found it out. Because I think that's what's really important for you to understand, how we can have a science of the mind, which we now do. How did we get to do that? How did we get to measure mental events? How do we make progress? What mistakes have we made? How do we correct the mistakes? So one of the things that I was doing was trying to get use psychology as a way of getting people to understand what science is. Because psychology is the newest science, as it were, natural science. And so we're very self-conscious about it. We really want to make sure we're scientists. Physicists don't worry about whether they're scientists. We do. And so it's a good, and also another thing about psychology is that it's interesting to people. You don't have to sell that a problem is interesting. People may not be interested in the problem in physics. It's pretty abstract. Things like, why do you love other people? You know, why do you behave this way? Why do you gamble? And things like that. Those are interesting things. So psychology is accessible. The science is much thinner. We don't know as much. So you can teach people, get them up to the present quickly. Now, my book is not just about psychology. It represents my background. It's biology and psychology. But both of those fields are relatively accessible. The advantage of biology is that we've had a couple of hundred years working on it. And we've made some major advances, like germ theory, like evolution, like DNA and genes. We don't have anything like that in psychology yet. We made a lot of progress, but we don't have some really great big ideas. So I want to use biology to do a little bit of teaching people how we got to those ideas. Where did we start? You know, how did it happen? Where were all the blind alleys? There were loads of blind alleys in science. The thing that people don't realize about science, which I'm trying to teach them, is that science isn't perfect. I call it the best show in town, but it's not a perfect show. And we make progress. The example I use is that life expectancy was 49 years in the United States in 1900. It's about 78 or so in 2000. 100 years. Enormous increase. That's due to science. But there was a lot of mistakes along the way. People thought something was, a disease was caused by something that it wasn't caused by. People thought that laziness was a cause of all kinds of illness. All kinds of things were wrong. But we had a system to correct that. We have a system where we do studies. We tell people how we did them. We do them carefully. We have other people look at them and evaluate them. Other people can say, well, that's not right. Here's another way to look at it. And we have a community of scientists which compare and evaluate. They can make mistakes over more than a decade, but they ultimately get it right. And that's what's so special about science in my view. So I'm trying to teach all of that in the context of, which includes some teaching about how we handle data, how do we make inferences from numbers, but it's also about how did we discover important things, and also about scientists are people. They're like other people. They want things like fame. They want to be successful. Sometimes they go a little too far in pushing the fame as opposed to the truth. It's not that they're some very rarely overtly dishonest, but rather they're shading things a little. And that's why we have peers, and that's why we have disputes. And that's all. Some people take it very personally. Some scientists take it personally, but they shouldn't. I don't mind being wrong. I've been wrong. I don't mind being wrong. I like to think that my errors were instructive, that they help people think better about a problem. But I don't have any special corner on the truth. So anyway, I'm trying to give people a sense of all of that, of this enormously successful enterprise, which has been challenged recently. That is to say, evidence-based things have been challenged, particularly in the last administration in the United States. And a lot of people have been suspicious of science. Now, there are grounds to be. Scientists make mistakes. Science makes mistakes. So that you can find shortcomings. But if you look at the total picture, the theory of evolution, the understanding of the gene, just talking about biology now, the ability to handle so many diseases, we're doing pretty well. And there's a lot more to be done.
I mean, you could say that if all of your science works out and all of your predictions work out, then either you're a fraud or you're not studying anything interesting, right?
Because well, there's a third possibility. You're not a fraud, but you are selecting.
Mm.
So you do three studies, two come out the way you like it. You only tell people about the two. That's not quite fraud. It's not like not telling people what you did. You could even tell them you did a third study. Put it somewhere at the end of your paper in another one sentence. No one will notice it. You know, there's all sorts of ways of, and it's actually part of good science to push your ideas. Yes, to challenge them, but also to push them, to be willing to keep stick with an idea, even if it can't explain all the things you'd like to explain. Most interesting ideas that turn out to be worthwhile can't explain everything when they start. They're trying to explain something, they explain it, and then it turns out maybe they push it and say, this is an explanation of much more, and maybe it is. So you have to have a little force behind your ideas, not too much so that you'll just crush anyone who disagrees with you, but enough to say, I'm going to keep going with this, even though there are some problems.
In your paper, you talk about informed curiosity and how much Solomon Asch valued it. And if I may, it seems like you're a very curious person. And that's just wonderful to see. And the energy you have and the intrinsic interest in just ideas and finding the truth, even if you have to take many turns to get there.
It's exciting to find truth. Let's not say truth. To make progress. It's exciting to make progress in understanding something. And you have to face the fact that sometimes what you think will be progress may not be. And also, but sometimes when it's not progress, it helped to make progress because it gave an alternative to what was a good, better solution. And you, by highlighting yours, made the better solution better. So, I mean, there are scientists who are intolerant of disagreement, but most of them are accepting of disagreement and to different degrees. Some of them are very promotional. Others are not at all promotional. Now, in a field like mathematics, where it's obvious that you've got the solution, you know, as it's a deductive, you can be pretty shy and non-promotional and be very successful. It's a little harder in the empirical sciences, certainly in psychology or biology. If you have a good idea and you sort of play with it and tell people about it, but you don't really push it, somebody else may push it, pick it up, really do important studies, and get the credit for it.
And humility is just such a beautiful trait for all kinds of things, right? We were talking earlier about how hard it is to understand just other people, not just people from other cultures, but just people in general, but just because it's hard to understand them doesn't mean we're not wildly overconfident in our abilities, right? Nick Epley has all this research where he asks people to predict what other people are thinking and then how confident they are. And we're just so overconfident that we understand what our friend is thinking, what our child is feeling. And oftentimes we're just completely wrong. And some humility can be really useful inside and outside of science.
And humility is a cultural variable. That is, we're not a culture that is big on humility. There's some advantage to being overconfident. Even in science, there's an advantage to being overconfident because you will stick with an idea for longer than you might otherwise. And sometimes that turns out to be really important. I mean, Marie Curie worked for, I don't know how many, I think it was decades, to push her idea. And she had to keep struggling to get this stuff extracted. And she finally did. Now, if it turned out her idea wasn't very good, she would have spent an awful lot of time for no purpose. But so sometimes that great push and confidence is important. People who have very little self-confidence have trouble in the world, and particularly in science. You have to have a certain amount of feeling that you have some agency, some way of accomplishing things, but you can have a little humility too. And of course, people vary. Scientists, the personality of scientists varies enormously. There are people who are successful scientists who are very demanding. They take more credit than they deserve in some sense. They're smart and they do good things. And there are other people who are much more more humility. They share their findings more with others. They give credit more. And they may be less famous. I mean, it is said, I don't know if this is true, but it's said that Isaac Newton, for example, is a very nasty fellow. I don't know if that's true, but it's one of these. Whereas other scientists, well-known ones, have been very good-natured about things. So, you know, it's if you want to get a Nobel Prize, you have to really push yourself. And you may have to be a little aggressive. If you don't care as much about getting a Nobel Prize, but your main, I mean, it overlaps with just trying to understand the world, of course. You know, if you're a little more modest, you may not get a Nobel Prize, but you may make a major contribution. So it's a matter, credit is a big issue in science. I ask scientists often the following question. Would you rather make an important finding and get credit for it, or make a much more important finding and get no credit for it? So in the second case, you're really making an advance to understand the world much bigger, but you're not going to get credit. And this puzzles a lot of scientists. They have trouble. They know they should make the second. They should say the second. But they really want to, you know, get their credit, understandably. It's very human. You get what you deserve. Anyway, so these are all interesting issues. I think the whole, the psychology of science is a very important thing. And graduate students in any field learn it. The psychology of, I don't even mean science. It could be any academic venture. I gave a course once at Penn called How Do You Know? Which was, how do you know anything? Okay. And the way the course went, it was an undergraduate course. I was the facilitator. And I brought five people in from five totally different fields. And they each got 2 weeks to tell the class how they found something out. Anything in their field. Political scientist, a law professor, a physicist, psychologist. And they each had their way of finding something out, but they all had something in common. They were trying to understand the world, and they were trying to do it in a disciplined way. They were all academics. They had, I have an idea. I want to see if it's true. And they used basically evidence, all of them, in very different fields. And the class could see that someone who's studying who wrote a particular piece of literature in England in 1600 is doing something somewhat like someone who's trying to understand how genes work. They're trying to have an idea, get evidence, and decide either to reject it or build it or change it. So it was a very interesting experience to get each of these people. I got really good people. And they were both good teachers and good scholars. The word is scholars, not scientists. So one of them, one of the people have the class read, this was a law person. They read a famous case in law from early in the 20th century in which a woman was on a train platform in New York City and was injured by trying to get on the train when the train was taking off. And there was a case between Long Island Railroad and the person. And the students read the case. Then they read the, it was not a jury case. Then they read the judge's decision about whether the Long Island Railroad was responsible for this. Then the case was appealed and the appeals court reversed the judge and they read the appeal. Then they went to the New York State Supreme Court and the Supreme Court reversed the appeal court. Mm. And all this was about what is evidence? Mm. What does it mean to say that someone was responsible? And it was just such a great experience. These are not people going into the law, but they're seeing the law is very articulate about this, much more than we are as scientists. But what is evidence? And what will we allow as evidence? So in the legal system in the United States, reasons I don't like this particular, you can't use person's past behavior as a base, as a piece of evidence for judging whether they committed a murder. So someone committed a murder. The fact that they previously committed 3 murders is not evidence. Hmm. I think it should be. But the point is that what the law has thought about this and decided, well, we're going to decide what would make you make a decision reasonably that this person is guilty or not. So the class got into all that. And then they would, another person did, how do we know what it was like for Mayans, how did Mayans people think in the Americas in 700 AD? And this was an archaeologist. And they asked for that. And then they did all sorts of other problems like that. And after you do about 5 of them, you get a sense of what the enterprise is. Hmm. The enterprise that unites all of us academics and many other people in the world. Not all people, but many. So that's part of what I'm trying to convey. And a lot of it isn't just science. It's clear, careful thinking, and open-mindedness, very important. Be aware of alternatives. Some people suggest that scientists should go out of the way to disprove the things that they're trying to show. Fortunately, if they don't do it, a lot of other people will try. A lot of other sites. So it's going to happen anyway. Anyway, so these are important things to me, and I'm enjoying working with them. And now I'm reading The Origin of Species for the first time in my life. I've done work on evolution and everything, but I never read the book, and it's great. And it's getting me to do this because I'm interested in how Darwin actually put this all together. And it's an amazing feat. And of course, it wasn't his original idea. I mean, other people, as he confessed, other people have had this idea, but they didn't really put any meat on it. They just sort of suggested. And what he did was a dedicated effort to really nail this. And it was great. It's great science. So anyway, that's what I do. I enjoy myself.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful circle to where we started the conversation, just as we're running up against time. Is there anything else you would like the world to know in the last few minutes that we have?
Well, I'd like the world to know. Oh, well, I worked for a while, for about 5 years in ethnic conflict. And I went to, because I'm a get into it. If you want to study something, the first thing to do is find out about it. So I spent a few months in Sri Lanka where there was a Tamil Buddhist long-standing thing. I spent a little time in Israel, Palestine, a little time in Northern Ireland, just to get some sense of what's going on. Not much. I mean, not what a real ethnographer would do. But the point is that that's really important. And there's a lot of psychology to do there to understand. What do you deal with? How do you deal with two people who hate each other as members of a group? say, Palestinians and Israelis, not all Israelis hate all Palestinians, but, you know, in general, how do you get them together? How do you give them a chance to see the other perspective, just to understand the other perspective? So my son, one of my sons is a playwright and a director. And one of the plays he produced some years ago was, it was a Middle Eastern play. It was based on a true story. And a young teenage woman, maybe 16, is raped in the first scene, Turkish woman. And the rest of the play is about how her family has to kill her. Because if they let her live, the whole family will be stigmatized. And the audience, the American audience, is aghast at this. How could this possibly be? How could a mother be? And by the intermission, they don't like the mother, but they understand the mother. The mother is saying, look, am I going to let my whole family go down the drain? Or just my daughter? So, but that change in perspective, at least you understand another perspective. My son's theater does a lot of this stuff. He just did one recently on female circumcision, which is a, you know, big controversial issue. But he did it from the point of view of this, of the West African woman, not the American. Americans who say this is, you know, this is a terrible thing. Well, as it's described, it is terrible, but it actually often is much milder than that. And often it's like a male circumcision. And we all allow our little boys to get their penis hacked, right? And nobody thinks much of it. So there's a whole bunch of perspectives, and Rick Schrader has written a wonderful paper about this, about female circumcision. And I read the paper and I gave it to my son, and he wrote a play about it. But the point is, one of the great things about theater and literature is that it lets you get into the head of another person and see how they see things. And if you do it with something that's really important and strong, like the Palestinian perspective, the Israeli perspective, those are important things to see. Where are these people coming from? These people that I can't stand. Why do they think that way? Why do they think that something that happened 400 years ago is something they still have to get revenge for? You know, things like that. Anyway, so that's psychology. And Marty Seligman, a prominent psychologist, in about 2000, argued as president of the American Psychological Association that psychologists have to take on ethnic conflict because there's a lot of psychology in that. And they're not doing it. And he got us to set up at Penn the first center in psychology based on ethnic conflict. I got involved in that. And it was an important idea. That's a hole in psychology. We know we have a lot to offer to that problem, and we can't stand by because it's too important a problem. You know, so anyway, and I'm very interested in the importance of drama in all of this, the theater in making people see another perspective. And the best way is to do it yourself, to be an actor. So my daughter in the fourth grade sang the lead in the Mikado. And she had to be a Japanese woman of a certain, you know, aristocracy. And she had to think like that and understand that. And that was more for her than our whole fourth grade. She learned more from being in that play. So these are all things that, I mean, there's so much interesting. So much.
And so many problems that have to be addressed. So what a beautiful message.
Well, I don't know if it's beautiful, maybe, but, and you know, your sponsor, Zaki, is interested now in theater as a means of expression. He's done some work on that. So you're right, it's right at your home. And there's my son is in a network of 30 plays, 30 theaters that does interesting theater on problems like what I've discussed. And the founder of that, David Goldman, is at Stanford.
And I actually read your son's play on female circumcision. And I can only recommend people check it out because it's...
You mean human rights?
Yes.
You read that play? That's, yeah. How come you read it?
Rick Schrader.
How did it come to you?
Rick Schrader sent it to me. I was talking to him the other day, and he forwarded this. And it's
Rick loved it. Rick Schrader came to the opening performance of that play from Chicago, and he gave a talk, and it was just one. It was one of the. I think the play was really good. It made an important point, and the fact is that it brought people together. The funny thing was that it was thought to, it was going to be very controversial, mm-hmm. and it wasn't. People disagreed with it, but it was good discussions. I went to 10 after play discussions, right? Wow. And they were just great. And it was so good to, it was an anthropologist who works on female circumcision from West Africa. And she was there and just, it was just great. It was everything that should be the case when you take a controversial issue and you just open it up a discussion with open minds. That was great. And Rick was the origin. So that's how you got it. He's a wonderful cultural psychologist. He's a really interesting mind.
That was a really wonderful conversation. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I also want to be aware of time.
Okay. And
just thank you for this wonderful conversation that I think many people will find useful. Thank you so much for your time.
You'll have to do some editing, but okay. Yeah, I'm thrilled that you read the play.